Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunked. This is Hero White, and our special guest today is Jim Davidson. He's back with us. Before, he was with us talking about his project at Individual Sovereign University. You can find that at indsovu.com. And he had a great episode with us on his experience in the U.S. with starting up a private space program. You can check out those podcasts on the website. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Today, I'd like to talk with you about your experiences and adventures in Africa and Somalia. So,
okay.
How did you get involved with heading over to Somalia, and what is it you were doing there? And can you just tell us some of the story?
Well, I guess the story kind of begins with the end of space travel services in 1991, when the state finally decided that what we had been doing was a sweepstakes all along, but they had succeeded in ruining our project in terms of making the market go away. So we agreed not to do sweepstakes activities in Texas anymore. And they agreed not to charge us with 675,000 counts of felony gambling promotion of the lottery. And that was probably the right thing to do. So we went our separate ways, and I got into real estate with a friend of mine, and we began talking about what to do next. And I concluded that what to do next was to find a free country where a person could actually do a business activity without being impeded the way we were. And so we set about doing that. One of the first things that came to our attention, because I was in the technology, so I was on the Internet. I know this sounds strange talking about the Internet in 1992, but there was. There were Usenet news groups, and there were email, and we had gopher sites and things like that. So I made contact with a group in the Las Vegas area calling itself the Atlantis Project. And their idea was that they were fed up with politics because of a great deal of fraud involving a state legislative contest for a woman named Tamara Clark, who was running for the state legislature in 1992. And they had kind of thrown in the towel on that. And so in early 1993, they began a project to create basically artificial platforms on the open ocean. And they called it the Atlantis Project, which is interesting because there have actually been several similar projects over the years.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 60s, there was one founded by soap magnate Werner Stiefel. And he had taken over a hotel in New York or New Jersey and was having people work on the project there. So I went out to Las Vegas in December of 93 and began working with a team out there. And we had a bunch of personality conflicts in the group. And I decided that it would be better use of my time to go back to Texas and work on a book called The Atlantis Papers, which described a constitution for the new country, Oceania. The constitution had been written in part by Eric Klein and, I guess, with some assistance from Mike Oliver, who had been involved, as you may know, in the Minerva Project in the early 70s.
Hmm.
So, you know, that that was supposed to result in a book, which I finished, and we were going to have the book on sale at a big conference at Caesars Palace, Las Vegas, in 1994. A friend of mine, Courtney Smith, put up like $50,000 to help make that happen. Several other people I know personally put up smaller amounts of money. And so the next step was to have that conference. Unfortunately, the money was under the control of Eric Klein. And as Chuck Geschleiter later discovered, Eric wasn't very honest with us. Eric had some open positions on Wall Street, on margin.
Oh, no.
And was infallible. I mean, as you know, if you have open positions, you must be infallible. And the market moved in a way that the market could not have moved. I mean, it just couldn't. It just it went against everything Eric believed.
Yeah.
And so he used the money to meet his margin calls. And then the market moved again. And he had no more money, and he lost it all.
Unbelievable.
My friend Lynn Atherton in Tulsa at the time confirmed that all this was going on, and she was very upset about it because, you know, she had taught him to have trailing stops and having stop-loss orders, you know, for his positions, but he wasn't doing that. So that all fell apart in 1994, and there was even more acrimony. Hooray. So in 1985, Courtney Smith invited me and John Kingman, whose family had invested in the Atlantis Project, and Mark Jaffe, who was an investor, and my friend Randy Dumpsey, who was very interested in the project, and David Meyer, who had worked with Manned Space Travel Services, and a bunch of other people.
Okay.
And we all got together in New York for a convention of the New Country Foundation, which later merged with the Free Nation Foundation, Free Country Foundation, to form the Free Nation Foundation.
Huh.
So anyway, nothing really came of that except that Courtney mentioned that a friend of his, Michael Van Noten, was looking for people who might be interested in working with him, a project along the north coast of Samoa. And the original idea in 1995 was to kind of buy long-term rights to the use of the island off the coast of Zela, which had been a traditional trading port and which we thought might be suited to a new country project.
Oh.
Or at least to a free port project. And so I began working with Michael in November or December of 1995. The conference was in November of 1995, and I remember one of the things that happened there was we had a cocktail party at Courtney's place, and I knew Courtney through his, I guess, girlfriend at the time, Brenda Peters, who was interested in longevity. She had been a big promoter of Alcor.
Oh, okay.
And one of the people I met at the cocktail party was a guy named John Perry, who I thought was a lawyer. He introduced himself as a lawyer and mentioned that he was acting in soap operas. I didn't find out that he was a police officer until September of 2001, when he was actually retiring the day the buildings fell down. And he responded to the call for all hands to help. And so he was in one of those towers when it fell down.
Why was he undercover? I mean, why did he say he was a lawyer?
I don't know. And that's very strange about this whole thing with John Perry. I don't know what he was doing there. I think he was interested in the project. He was very interested in the driver license I had from a fictitious country called Celeste, and asked me if he could get one like it, and I said sure, but I had a weird feeling about it, so I never sent him that. He sent me a photograph, and I did some online research, and I just had a weird feeling about it, and I didn't send him a driver license, so that probably ended well for me. Anyway, so the next part of the story is in 1998, when we organized a trip for John Kingman to go over to Kismayo. Michael had had some contacts there who thought that a free port in Kismayo would be very helpful. And so we smuggled John into the country as an equal weight of cat, which is the local... I guess you could call it narcotic. It's actually an amphetamine. But they fly it in from Nairobi or from Ethiopia. And so basically by buying his weight in that material, we got him into the country. And he did some ground truth work there. What, you didn't know that they didn't have scheduled air flights until like 2000, 2001. Yeah, that's tough. It's tough getting into parts of Somalia. It still is. You know, the UN doesn't like them. Boutros Ghali was very angry when his friend Siad Barre was ousted by these peasants.
So any American that would go over there, or maybe from lots of other countries, they just would be refused entry. Is that it?
Well, it's not really clear. I mean, later it became possible to just take a Dallo Airlines flight from Djibouti, and that's what I did when I entered the country in 2000. But for a long time, yes, it was very difficult. There was no scheduled airline travel, and there was no way to cross the border without violating U.S. law.
Oh, okay.
And so basically you had to smuggle yourself into the country. I assume the statute of limitations has passed by now. It's been 13 years. So I don't think John's in any trouble. And my passport was actually stamped not only with the entry visa, but also with the expulsion order in 2001. So when I renewed my passport the last time, nobody complained. So I assume that I'm in some record book in the State Department as being one of these strange people.
Yeah. What did you guys find when you got in there?
Well, our objective was to build a free port on the coast. Actually, it ended up being between Ceylon and Lucaya at a place called Balado. And what we found was a very good place to build a port. There are two very large coral reefs offshore that direct a lot of flow out of the Gulf of Aden into what's basically an estuary. And it created a very deep area immediately offshore within about 100 yards of shore. We had a measured sounding of 25 meters. So really, really quite deep in terms of the kinds of ships you could take in there. So it seemed like an ideal place, and we had reached an agreement with the locals in Audal. The local elders in their community had felt that it was a good thing. I spent quite a bit of time in country. We went to a place where they have a lot of emerald mining activity. They didn't want to actually show me the emeralds, you know, in the mountain, but they showed me some samples that they had carved out. And they needed a lot better tools to harvest their emeralds because there were stress fractures all through the gems. It was very unlikely we were going to get any value out of them if we, you know, took them to a jewelry store to sell. So we looked at a lot of that stuff. We also did a lot of work in London, characterizing that part of the world for geology in order to, you know, get data on what the British had known. Because it was, you know, British Somaliland up until 1960. Well, from 1895 up to 1960. Mm-hmm. And so they had a lot of records in their publicly available archives in, I guess it's Kew Gardens. Very Brazil type of, reminded me of information retrieval in Brazil. It's a very, the computers, the record. You make a quest that they retrieve the information, and the information retrieval goes into their Iranian archives and grabs the material, and it showed up a little later in a cubby hole, and you go and look at the stuff, and then you make more requests. I found quite a number of the documents were what they called confounded, which is a British term meaning fucked up. They had a record that it was in their archive, but then when they looked, it wasn't there. So that's, you know, fucked up. And that meant that we couldn't, you know, access some of the information we wanted. But
so you were looking at doing a port in this island and doing mining there?
Well, we were interested in basically bringing as much activity to the area as we could.
Okay.
Because if there was a free port and there's nothing going out, then the shippers would be unhappy. See, the economic situation in the region relates to a war in 1993, well, which ended in 1993, when Ethiopia was forced to adopt the new constitution. The United States forced the issue. And allowing for the secession of regions within Ethiopia. And one of those regions was Eritrea, which is the entire coast along the Red Sea. The United States wanted a Red Sea coast ally with military bases, U.S. military bases authorized by that ally. And so Eritrea became a new country as a result of this political wrangling. Mm-hmm. And that made Ethiopia a landlocked country. There are two major ports that serve Ethiopia. In Kenya, the port is Mombasa. And in Djibouti, the port is Djibouti. I believe the only rail line to the capital, Addis Ababa, is still from Djibouti. And the Djiboutians were formerly a French colony. Their Somali clan is the, I believe it's the Issa. And they were very happy to exploit this monopoly of rail capacity to the Ethiopian capital. And so if you took, at the time we were doing our research, if you took a container off of a boat, off of a ship, at the port of Dubai, it was $150. If you did the same trick at the port of Djibouti, it was $1,500.
Wow.
So they were, you know, they were clearly exploiting this opportunity, and we thought, well, hell, you know, let's break the monopoly.
Uh-huh.
We'll build a toll road from our port up into Ethiopia, and we'll charge slightly less, and this will create competition, and that'll be good. And a lot of container vessels will come and want to offload at our port. That's
right.
Great. But then they're going to want to load something when they go home.
Okay.
Right? I mean, shipping empty containers is a pain in the ass. No one likes the deadhead. So, well, all right, well, we can rely on Ethiopia to provide some exports. But we'd also like to develop the local economy so that there are other things to export. So we were looking into mining.
Uh-huh.
They have a huge resource of tantalum in particular part. Tantalum?
Mm-hmm.
I think on the periodic table it's number 73.
What is that used for?
It's a very interesting material with different electronic and high-tech, you know, applications.
Oh, okay.
Tantalum and niobium, I think, are the two chemicals. It comes from a mineral called columbite, I think. You could look that up, too. Anyway, we found a very interesting outcropping of tantalum-rich ore, and we found a lot of other information about previous work done by Chevron and Conoco and Phillips and I think Sinclair and, of course, British Petroleum. There were asphalt pits. There are places in the area near Hargeisa where oil just seeps up through the ground. So there was an opportunity. I think that's between Hargeisa and Berbera. So there was an opportunity there to have, you know, oil exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Chevron had been doing oil exploration up until 1991. The other companies mostly got out in 1988 when the IMF became nervous. See, the IMF had lent the dictator, Ziad Barr, $300 million or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And he had used all that money to attack people in Berbera and Hargeisa who were part of the Somali national movement and wanted to have a separate country, wanted to have Somaliland be separate from Somalia. And so slaughtered like 30,000 civilians in Berbera, mass graves, hired a guy named Dahir Rayal to be an expert at torture, and torture just a whole bunch of people. So the IMF decided not to lend him any more money, but they still want their money back, you understand?
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, they lent it to the regime. And the fact that the regime was a dictatorship and the people didn't elect him and they didn't want him in there doesn't matter. They still have to pay.
Yeah, and they know, you know, how is this guy going to collect his taxes, you know? You pay us back this $300 million. How do you think he's going to get that money?
Actually, it's all together $2.6 billion that he ended up owing. He fled to originally to Nairobi and ended up in Abu Dhabi. And I think he's dead now. I think he died in like 1993.
And did they forgive the debt? Or are they
no,
back
no,
on the
exactly? It's still in the book.
Yeah, it's on
if
the country's books.
If you look at the CIA World Fact Book on Somalia, they still owe $2.6 billion, which, you know, is roughly the gross domestic product of Somalia. So if everyone in Somalia would simply make do without any money for a year, the bankers would be paid back. The bankers don't really want to be paid back. They want the debt to be serviced, though. So it's all just a mess. And it's really, you know, it's all funny money, too, because they've already written it off their books. You know, it's been since 1991. So, you know, it's all already charged off their balance sheets as bad debt. But that is why the UN sent troops in 1992. That's why. I mean, there was no famine. There was some distribution problems in Mogadishu, which were very widely covered, but that was all bullshit. If you went up and down the Shabili and Juba River valleys, you would find that there was warehouses full of food. And indeed, the U.S. military did that after they arrived in December of 92. The Marine Corps Commandant concluded in April of 93 that there was no famine, that now that there was food distribution in the city, there was plenty of food. And so I think it was bullshit all along. I think it was Boutros-Ghali, the Secretary General of the UN, wanting to reinstate the power of his former friend, because he had been an Egyptian diplomat before he was a UN diplomat. And he was, I think, ambassador from Egypt to Somalia.
Wow.
And so he knew this guy. I mean, and they were buddies, and
yeah.
And so that's why the UN wanted all those troops in there, and that's why the UN continues to insist that there be a peace conference and that there be a national government for Somalia. And
yeah, now they're pushing for that in the name of anti-Muslim terrorist possibilities.
Right. Now the problem is not that there's a famine in Somalia, but that there are, I think, altogether identifiable 200 individual Somalis who are part of Al-Ittihad, Al-Islamiyya, which is supposedly a terrorist organization. And there was that brief episode in 2005 when they took over Mogadishu as the Islamic Courts Union. Not those 200 guys, but you know, other fundamentalist Muslims took over Mogadishu. That was ended by the United States basically going to war, sending 10th Mountain Division and AC-160, the airplane that acts like a tank, just slaughtered a whole bunch of people. It's really, really quite nasty. Most Americans don't know that they were at war in Somalia in 2006, but they were.
Yeah.
It's even on Wikipedia.
Antiwar.com had some coverage on this.
Well, yeah, Antiwar.com is an interesting outfit. A bunch of fat people who sit on their asses and type, I think. I don't know what wars they've ever ended or what actually they do that's anti-war except... well, sit on their asses and type, but, you know,
yeah,
there
well,
is that.
There was, I think it was Justin Raimondo covered a bunch of stuff on the stuff with Somalia and talking about how even in the past few years how the U.S. government is funding particular groups in bordering countries to Somalia and then those groups then invading Somalia, and then the U.S. stands back and you know, it's sort of a...
and washes the mess.
Proxy, yeah.
Yeah, and that's been going on for a long, long time. You know that in 1993, as a result of all this invasion by the U.N. and the U.S., a group of Somalis led by a guy named Mohammed Aidid, calling themselves the Haber Gadir clan, which is a very ancient and venerable clan. The Haber Gadir had a radio station in Mogadishu, and they were broadcasting information about the true facts of the UN invasion. And the UN didn't like that. The UN doesn't like anybody having free speech. The UN doesn't want anyone to resist UN authority. And they also have an armory next to the radio station. And so the UN sent, I think, 19 Pakistani troops wearing the blue helmets to inspect the radio station. And everyone believes that the intention was to shut it down and to seize the armory of the militia. And I think this was in May of 1993. This was after the Marine Corps commandant had ordered the removal of all the Marines mm-hmm. on the grounds that the famine was over. Well, the Habrigadier militia resisted and killed all 19 of those Pakistani troops. And I gather eviscerated them and put their bodies on display mm-hmm. As a way of saying, you know, don't come back.
Right.
This leads to the UN declaring Aidid a war criminal and declaring that you know, to get control of Mogadishu, there must be a capture Aidid plan. And so the Clinton administration sent, I think it was 19 attack helicopters. And this would have been, I think, July of 1993. You can look it up.
Uh-huh.
But they surrounded this apartment building where 200 Klansmen were meeting to sue for peace. They were meeting to come to grips with the fact that they were at war with the entire world, and they wanted to not be at war, and they were going to sue for peace, and they wanted to talk about what they were going to do. And the attack helicopters fired upon the apartment building with TOW missiles and 30-millimeter cannon and just wiped out, you know, almost all of those people.
Wow.
People on the first floor were women and children, you know, preparing the meals for the men upstairs. They ran out of the building and were actually chased down the streets by the helicopters, slaughtering. And so this incident was, you know, this is not mentioned in the movie Black Hawk Down, but it's actually a prominent part of the book Black Hawk Down, because it gives you the context for why the Somalis are fucked at U.S. And so you have six Black Hawk helicopters between the 4th week of September and the 1st week of October being shot down. Six helicopters in 2 weeks shot down by small arms fire, by rocket-propelled grenades launched from the ground.
And this was after that incident?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
This was in October of 1993, after the helicopters had attacked. Well, it was effectively a peaceful clan gathering that was making plans to sue for peace. All of the peaceniks were there. They were all killed. So, you know, then it was war. So there was a known problem with the Black Hawk helicopter. In fact, I have a 1993 Aviation Week magazine which describes 10 years earlier how there's a problem with the Black Hawk tail rotor. It's vulnerable to small arms fire.
Oh, no.
But, you know, if you fire a rocket-propelled grenade into the air, the backwash from the rocket will hit the ground behind you and knock your legs out from under you. So, you know, there's no way to do that, right? So what did the fucking Somalis? The Somalis didn't know this, so they dug a trench behind the guy. So the guy stands in front of a trench that's 6 feet deep and directs the plume of gas away from him. And then he's quite happy to fire into the sky. And they did this from the top of roofs with a hole cut into the floor below. so they managed six times to knock the helicopters out of the sky. Fucking Blackhawks.
Wow.
So, you know, they were pissed. And as you know, there was a hunt for Muhammad Aidid. That was why the Task Force Ranger went to the Olympic Hotel when their helicopter was shot down, yada, yada. So what came of that? Well, in 1995, the U.S. actually airlifted, the U.S. military airlifted ID to a conference. I think it was in Ethiopia, but I could be wrong. And they had a peace conference, and they said, well, okay, why don't you form a government for Somalia and become president? And so he did. He came back to Mogadishu, and he said, well, I'm going to form a government. I'm going to be president, and we're going to end the hostilities, and everything's going to be good. And the elders of his clan looked at this and said, well, this is a war leader, a militia leader, who is out of control. So we have to bring him back under control. And so for a couple of weeks, they talked to him. Then they hired one of his bodyguards to kill him. And he was killed. And that was the end of IDEED and that particular peace conference. So almost immediately, Ethiopia sent 500 troops over the border into northern Somalia. And they were beaten back. A couple of weeks later, a bunch of unlabeled people, probably special forces, probably from France, crossed the border from Djibouti. A couple of dozen guys, they got killed, and the Somalis didn't know what to do with them. They always knew what to do with the Ethiopians. They just took everything the Ethiopians had and turned them bodies over at the border. But the special forces guys, they were kind of worried about it, because it was obviously some great power. It was some European power, not... they weren't Djiboutian.
Yeah.
So they left them in their kit at the border, crossing into Djibouti. You know. And you know, it's very interesting that since 1991, Ethiopia and Djibouti and Uganda have sent troops into Somalia, and Somalia still doesn't have a national government. People in Somalia don't want a national government. Because, you know, they tried that. They had colonialism between 1895 and 1960. They had a corrupt European-oriented parliament, democracy, if you will. And they didn't like that. 1960 to 1969. That was overthrown in 69 by Ziad Barre, who I think he killed the president and kidnapped the prime minister, or it might be the other way around. Anyway, you can look that up. But he became a Marxist dictator from 1969 until 1978 when the Soviet Union decided to back Ethiopia in the war over the Agadez, which Soviet scientists had found an enormous natural gas field under the Agadez Desert. And the Somalis considered Ogaden part of their territory. The British had actually given it away in 1954. Western Adal and the Ogaden and Sul and Sanaag were given to Ethiopia to form a region of Ethiopia. And this was like, the Somalis were like, what the hell? You know, what's this crown protectorate of British Somaliland about if you're not going to protect our interests?
Yeah.
Anyway, so they wanted it back, and Ziad Barre's particular clan is from Ogaden, and so it was, you know, natural repatriation of our territory thing. And they attacked Ethiopia, and the Soviets backed Ethiopia. If you look at the mineral map, it's very clear why. The Soviets found gold and platinum and uranium all over Ethiopia. They found a tiny bit of uranium and thorium near Mogadishu, and very little gold, essentially nothing else, no platinum group metals. So, you know, they picked the resource-rich country and backed it and defeated the Somalis with air superiority. And so the 1978 war was lost, and Ziad Barre decided that he was no longer a Marxist. and he became a Western-backed dictator. And so, you know, the Somalis have had it all. They've had democracy, they've had colonialism, they've had a Marxist dictatorship, and they've had a non-Marxist dictatorship. So what's left? I mean, what does the West have to offer in terms of a national government? You know, they've tried it all, and none of it works for them. So they want to live their lives the way they always have, with their traditional laws.
And their tribal regions.
Yeah, it's not really tribal. The term really is clan.
Clan, okay.
A tribe is a much more amorphous group, and a clan is much more family lineages. And they have, you know, they have an understanding of genetics, so they have people from outside their clan marry, you know, into the clan, so that there's a mixing of the gene pool, so they don't get an inbreeding problem.
Right.
But yeah, they're interested in living in Somalia, in their own country, their own way. And of course, the UN is against this, and the U.S. is against this, and constantly sends in troops, constantly calls for a peace conference, forms a transitional national government that ends up becoming the mayor of Mogadishu, that ends up becoming, you know, the possessors of two square blocks of Mogadishu, and then they flee. It's all terribly corrupt and tedious, and you know, it's the banker's fault.
Yeah.
It's the International Monetary Fund, you know, on the sidelines, cheering for more chaos in Somalia so that someone will eventually capitulate and pay them back their money.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I think so. My attitude is fuck the bankers, and the Somalis' attitude is to hell with the bankers.
Yeah, right.
We wouldn't even fuck them.
So you were in, you entered in after the bulk of all these incidents that you talked about. How did you see the people there look, and how did they feel about you working with them and your ideas?
Well, it wasn't just me, of course. It was me and Michael Van Noten, who's Dutch, and we were, you know, not representing the United States or Holland. We were representing business interests, and they were very interested in doing business. They're very interested in selling emeralds, you know, which are, you know, unlike diamonds, emeralds are actually rare, have an authentic scarcity issue.
Mm-hmm.
They're very interested in mining companies. While I was there, I met some British guy who was representing a mining company that had official approval from the government in Hargeisa to do mining work in that region. And, you know, I met people from Italy at the Coppi Italiano. Some of them worked in the hospital there in Borama, where I was staying, and some of them were doing various other projects, you know, wells and agriculture-related projects.
Now, if there's no
go ahead.
If there's no central government there now, or at the time that you were there, well, and then when you went to a particular area, who did you deal with to possibly get some type of encouragement or knowledge that this was even possible to put up a port there in the island?
Well, the people we were dealing with were the elders of the Semeron clan.
Okay.
These were people that Michael knew very well in 1991, he was in Mogadishu. He was called Bulletproof Mike because he could walk around the streets and not get shot. And people were very impressed by that. He married a Somali woman, an elderly Somali woman. The Somalis are kind of xenophobic, and they're really weird about mixed-race children as a concept. They're not big on that. So he married a woman who was clearly past menopause.
Okay.
And she had been raised Catholic in Djibouti, but she was from the Semeron clan, and she was well-known in the community. So he was the brother-in-law of all these people.
Wow.
And that's a very, and they have a short word for that. You know, we say brother-in-law, that's a long word. Their word is Seti. And Seti is, you know, is brother-in-law. And it's an important relationship because the brother-in-law will often take care of the children of the family. He'll often help the cousins and the nephews. So brother-in-law is an important relationship, and it's a very honored thing. And so the people in Adal wanted to agree to let us build a free port and a toll road in their country. But the people in the clan next door, the Isak, were the people running the government in Hargeisa for the Republic of Somaliland. And they didn't want this to happen. They wanted Berbera to be the port, and they wanted a kind of road into Ethiopia to go through Berbera, because that was Isak territory. And so there was a certain amount of animosity there.
Yeah, they wanted the road and the port. It sounds like another just attempt at monopolization rather than just allowing anyone to put up whatever road they want and then putting up the road they want.
You know how people are in government, Hero.
Yeah. I mean,
they have a really big fixation about roads. I think it goes back to the Romans. The Romans were very weird about roads, too.
Well, you weren't asking
as if they had invented them.
You weren't asking for financing. You weren't asking for a contract. This was a
privately financed... No, we weren't asking for financing or a contract or a concession. We didn't want to have a monopoly. What we wanted was permission from the local people who owned the local land to have usufruct, to have the fruits of the usage of the land, which we would improve. We had investors. Most of my time was actually spent in Europe for this project, as with many African projects, meeting with people who had money, meeting with Dutch insurance companies that had an interest in the problem of piracy along the Gulf of Aden coast, and we were going to provide protection against piracy. We were going to have our own patrol vessels.
Great.
We were hoping to have cruise ships dock at our port. And so we needed to provide, you know, some security to protect those cruise ships from piracy, both coming and going. And so we had this whole network of people who were ready to back us and wanted to be involved.
Yeah.
And had committed about $20 million. In August of 2001, I was in Djibouti working on a fishing port project where we were going to use some of the facilities at Djibouti to work with a fishing fleet that we were installing in Adal, and then we were eventually going to bring in our own freezer boat, you know, with a capacity to manufacture frozen fish offshore. Djibouti was at the time compliant with the European Union requirements for exporting fish to Europe. So we were going to work with them. And I left Djibouti in late August, and we had a bunch of meetings suddenly canceled in Europe in early September. And so I went back to Texas, and I was actually in Texas when the September 11th attacks took place. And after that, it was very hard to get people to answer our phone calls. We would call them up and say, you know, we just want to check in, make sure everything's cool. And, you know, we're still going to go ahead. We're just not sure exactly how. And then I think it was September 19th, or might have been October of 2001, General Tommy Franks of NATO announces that it is official policy of NATO to bomb all the port facilities in Somalia. Someday.
What?
And yeah, that was announced policy. General Tommy Franks announced that there was a policy of NATO that Somalia was one of these axis of evil countries and that it had to be suppressed and that one of the things they would do would be bomb all the port facilities. in Somalia. And that was where our funding disappeared.
Oh, my goodness.
After that, people wouldn't answer our calls at all.
Wow. Yeah. You know, at the time, I heard about the port project and the highway project when you were working on it. And
yeah.
I was contacted. I knew John Kingman at the time and some people involved with it. They were talking about investment. And I was going to throw a couple hundred dollars toward it, to be part of it because it was fantastic. And, this happened and that happened. And then a couple months later, I was told that it was over. It was dried up. And I didn't know what had actually happened to it. I never heard the story. But it was around the time of the 9/11. So this is just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what happened. What happened basically was it was in NATO policy to create an unworkable business environment for people building port projects in Somalia. And so, that was the end of that. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out a way around that, trying to get NATO to adopt a different policy. We didn't have any pull there. I still don't know anyone who has any connections with those people. In 2006, they went ahead and made good on that promise and bombed the fuck out of the port of Mogadishu and the port of Kismayo, and I think also Marka. One of the cities in between.
You guys would have been laid to waste if you had anything going there also.
Well, that was the immediate conclusion of the people who were going to finance the project. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
which is too bad because we had all the equipment ordered in Rotterdam and we were about to take delivery and we were about to make our payments, and money dries up and project blows away.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine that if they're bombing these ports over there on the coast, that they would have said, "Oh, let's leave this one alone. Let's leave this one alone because this is a private operation with innocent people running it."
Well, I don't see the U.S. military having any compunction like that.
No, not at all.
I suppose one could have, one could have negotiated for that. But we didn't have a port. That was the problem, the chicken and the egg problem. You can't have a port without money. You can't have money without a stable business climate, and we didn't have a stable business climate. We had a mess. And it wasn't a mess of our making, but it was our problem. And so that project did not persist.
Wow. That's something else. Well, it's 10 years later, and, and there's, or 12 or whatever, and not much has changed, if not, It's worse now in terms of the...
Oh, come on. Come on, hero. Osama bin Laden is dead. Didn't you see the photographs? I mean, didn't you hear about the photographs that you can't see?
Yeah,
Everything's changed.
I saw this one photo that was flying around on the net. It said the White House releases photographic evidence of his death, and it was... a picture of a body of water with a sandal floating.
Yeah, floating sandal. Yeah, yeah, I saw that. I was on Orland Krabby's site. The late great Orland Krabby.
Yeah.
There's a cartoon. Rex May, used to be a friend of mine on Facebook, posted on the front of, I think it's on the front of the Libertarian Enterprise today, ncc-1776.org. It shows President Obama with a rifle, and he's shot Osama bin Laden in the head. And he said, "I'm sorry about that, but it was the only way to get Donald Trump to shut up about my college grades." So now Obama has a 60% approval rating. Yay. The economy is still fucked because, people with innovative ideas can't do business. What we still have officially, it's something like 10% unemployment, and unofficially something like 23%.
Yeah.
We have holes all over the country where it's much worse than 23%. Up to 50% of urban young men in different parts of the country can't find jobs, can't support families, can't do anything. We have, 43 million Americans on food stamps? And this is, the all-time record. And I think for the last 11 months, every month has been an all-time record.
Yeah. Right.
On, food, people can't get food, so they're on food stamps. And it's, it's sad. You're standing in the grocery line, and here's this pregnant woman standing in front of you doing the food stamp thing and going through all the hassles of which foods are WIC approved and which foods she can pay with this or that. And, it's just sad.
Yeah.
There used to be a country here, and now it's a mess. And the people in power made the mess. I mean, I don't know what you believe about September 11th, and I don't know what to believe about it either. But it certainly had nothing to do with Iraq.
Well, yeah. Well,
there's a guy named Wesley Clark. I don't know if you've heard of him. Wesley Clark, I think it's his name, yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the commanders.
He's like a general or
yeah, uh-huh.
Formerly a general. And he was in the Pentagon. He does an interview on YouTube. You can probably find it. And he was in the Pentagon the 19th or so of September. He's in one of these rooms, one of these hallways where there's lots of, war planning operation stuff going on. And he goes... walking down this hall, and this other general wants to talk to him and calls to him and kind of comes out of the hallway and grabs him and pulls him into this room and says, I wanted you to know about all of this work we're doing for the invasion of Iraq. And this is September 19th, 2001. This is 2 years before the invasion, right?
Uh-huh.
So, Clark is like, well, did we find out that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11? And the other general's like, oh, no, we don't know anything. We're just doing these war plans because, we want to invade Iraq. And a couple of weeks later, sometime in October, he goes back down the same hallway. The same general collars him and brings him into the office to talk about the invasions of Syria, Libya, Yemen. In addition to Afghanistan and Iraq, they're going to attack Somalia. They're going to attack all these countries. I think there were a total of 7 countries. You can probably find the YouTube clip and get all the details. But,
yeah.
It's just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That NATO planes are flying over Libya this year suddenly.
Yeah.
And there's suddenly a revolution on the ground in Syria. There's a revolution on the ground in Yemen. How did all this happen? The people who run the world want to have lots of wars because they make lots of profits from the military contractor companies. Or as John Lennon said in an interview before he was killed, the people who run the world are fundamentally insane, and they run it for fundamentally insane purposes.
Yeah.
That's where we are, man.
Well, with all this unemployment, the Soviet Union and Rome, they had some jobs for all the young men, no? Join the military.
What do you mean?
Well, join the military.
Well, right,
and send
but
them
you
off.
Know, we don't have that kind of military. There's what, 185,000 people in the US army, I think. Something like that. This is not the 2 million man army that there once was. This is not the conscription army that went over to Vietnam.
Yeah, well, think of World War II.
They know that's unpopular. They know that if they do that again, there will be riots in the street, and the whole fucking system will be burnt to the ground by people who have been through this before.
Yeah.
We're not going to have a military draft in this country. We got rid of a lot of the recruiters on campus, though after 2001 they were brought back. Not only for the military, but for the CIA.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
They can get away with it a lot more when when they have good reasons, you know, like World War II, it was all for a good cause to, you know, enlist everyone and bring up employment to, you know, build and maintain the war machine.
Well, as you know, some people believe that kind of nonsense. Of course, I don't. This is something Bastiat wrote about in a book, That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen, which has the lovely acronym Twice a Twins. The broken window fallacy, you've probably heard of it.
Yep.
That if you simply break enough things, we'll get the economy back online.
Yeah. No.
And you it doesn't work because of the opportunity cost.
Right. Yeah, and there's the production is not going. It's not production. It's just going into destruction, and even all of that is financed through debt and inflation.
It's financed through debt, and it's financed through taxation, which is theft.
Yep.
Right, and so if you steal a man's money, then you can fix everything. Well, no, you can't, because that creates the opportunity cost. What could he have done with his own money in his own interest?
Yeah.
He's fucked out of that. So you end up with, well, you know, a mess. And that's what we've got. We've got a mess, and the people involved want to double down. And I don't. You know, that's why I'm interested in agorism. That's why we founded the University Project. That's why we're trying to create opportunities for people to learn how to get out of the system and how to get away from things that oppress them. I think that's probably the motivation behind the Second Realm, right?
Yeah, right. Well, and that's
why you guys are doing what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, on interesting notes in some of the news, the guy, one of the guys, ZZZ from the I2P project, said that the number of nodes in the I2P, it's a dark net, a big, huge, anonymous darknet system, traffic has increased by 30 or 40% just over the past 3 weeks. Not traffic, but the number of nodes. The network has expanded. So there's...
Yeah, it's good. It's good news. You know?
Yeah, we were talking about this inside the Agora channel this morning that, let's see, BitTorrent now has released this new P2P hosting thing where you can put up files for other people and from a white list of specific friends, and they can log in and get them. And then the W3C, which is, you know, big deal, but they do a lot of work in the internet standards, establishing internet standards. They're working on a new project for P2P for the web browser standard for allowing for P2P web surfing and hosting and email and chat. So, and then Canada is announcing some type of thing for outlawing anonymity and linking to things that they don't like. You know, there's so much activity going on that, and you can make comments about all those things, but what I see all of them are signals. They're signals to things that are going on, you know, and activity, all the Bitcoin stuff that's going on. I don't know what's going to happen with Bitcoin. But to me, that is what's important. What I see about happening with the Bitcoin stuff is that the number of people that are talking about money and are interested now with a fire under them to create an alternative money system, or to make it so that a bankster can't crush it.
Systems.
Yeah. So it's exciting.
Because Bitcoin, I think there's been some recent discussion on the gold, silver, crypto list about some of the problems with Bitcoin and its design and some of the potential for it being taken over and miners who are not approved getting fucked over.
We did a show on that.
Which would be bad.
Yeah.
And you've done a show on that, and there's been some work on making corrections to that. And so I think Bitcoin is an interesting model. It's a model, though, of fiat money. It's a model of money that's accepted in trade because it's accepted in trade, not because there's any underlying value. There's no
inherent in it,
tie to gold or silver. It's and so I think it's an interesting model, and I also like the fact that there's others out there, like the VoucherSafe Project, the Open Transactions Group, the people working with Bill St. Clair on his thing.
True Ledger.
The True Ledger, thank you. The Loom.cc, which is an exchange system, which can really work with anything.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the Globals, the Gold Globals, the Global Settlement Foundation, those people are working with Loom. So there's sort of an interaction there. And that's, of course, the tie to gold and silver with their currencies.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that there's a free market for money that's developing.
Yes.
And really growing very rapidly. Mm-hmm. Because the market will choose really good money.
Yeah.
The market will choose money that's really, really good. And this is something that Friedrich von Hayek wrote about in 1976 in a seminal essay called The Denationalization of Money, which is often held out as sort of the foundation for the European Union monetary union, which is bullshit. He actually went the other way. He was talking about having it all private and having, you know, individual issuers of money be competing with one another.
Yeah, and when he said denationalization, he didn't mean let's move up to a global currency instead of national currencies. Yeah, it was the other way around.
Right, no, in fact, he talked about the value of competing currencies, that having that Europe was actually successful because there were many competing currencies.
Yeah.
And that if there were a problem with Greece having too much debt, that affected the Greek currency and it didn't screw over the Germans. And lo and behold, what have we learned?
Yeah. Right now,
the Greeks have too much debt, and the Germans are fucked over.
Yeah,
and so are the Spaniards and the Portuguese and the French and the British, to some extent. You know, depending upon who they owe the money to.
Right.
You know, it's a mess. A sovereign debt crisis is a mess, and this has brought a lot of attention to money, and that's a good thing, because people really need to have a good idea about how their wealth is stored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're storing your wealth in the bank, you're going to be screwed. There's going to be a bank holiday, and you're not going to be able to get at it. If you're storing your money, if you're storing your wealth as, let's say, gold coins in a safety deposit box, the bank doesn't refer to your safety when they say safety deposit box. It's the bank's safety. And during the gold confiscations in the 1930s, when FDR outlawed Americans owning gold, he sent the Secret Service around to the banks, and they went through safety deposit boxes, and they took gold coins. They confiscated a lot of that stuff. They got about 78% either voluntarily turned in because of the promised price hike,
okay,
the monetary inflation,
right,
or confiscated, which just goes to show you about a fifth of the population ain't buying it, no matter what's for sale.
Yeah, right, yeah.
They're not hiding their money in the bank. They're hiding it under the floorboards.
Right.
They're not working with the government under any circumstances. And I think that's expanded. I think that you can look at figures that I've analyzed about voting, that roughly a third of the population, something like 120 million Americans who are qualified to vote, do not vote. Many of them aren't even registered because they don't believe the system works. They don't believe the system has anything for them. They don't even believe their votes would be counted.
Mm-hmm.
And a very similar number in 2010, something like 110 million, did not file income taxes. Are expected, you know, they're income earners. They have jobs of some sort, and the IRS expects them to file, but they did not file. And this has grown from 1998 when IRS reported it at 66 million.
Yeah, this ties in with the show we did this week also with Ben Godwin and Harold Gray from the JustLive.us. They have a new site up called.
I'm a big fan of Harold Gray. Postpolitical, right?
Yeah, postpolitical.us. It's great. The whole show was about the same thing, that, you know, forget about financing Ron Paul right now. Take your money and throw it into a project that you believe in. And if a lot of people out there are saying, well, you think that your vote doesn't matter, but it does, because if we get enough people that do it, we can make change. And what these guys are showing in their website is And what a lot of us are saying, if you think that your vote is going to work, and that if that's your framework of throwing something little towards something to make it big, then take what little you have and throw it towards something you believe in, and
right,
and build, and you know, direct political action, or not political action, direct market action, and put your money towards someone who's going to be producing or creating something that you believe in, you know. So
right, or create it yourself.
Get out there, invest in yourself. And then
this is one of the reasons for our university project, is to have people come to IND SFVU and teach or learn for money and invest in, I mean, what is learning? Learning is an investment in your individual capital, you know, your capital, plant and equipment, if you will. Your mind becomes more flexible the more you learn, and it becomes more operative, I mean, more capable with more knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to get people to see that this is long-term a major possibility. And, you know, we talked about this when we had the original show on the university. I still haven't heard from a lot of people who want to help us with the website.
Oh.
Or with new websites to do this in alternative currencies.
Let's talk about that real quick. I actually had that on my agenda before the end of the show. Is I wanted to go over what your exact requirements or general requirements that you needed for changing your website, what you're looking for in a programmer.
Well, really, the only thing that I'm concerned about is the existing forum, which lists all of the courses being ported in some way to whatever the new thing is. I don't really have any requirements in terms of what software is used or, you know, how it works or how it's implemented. I just want a site that people find easy to use that allows them not only to use our existing Google checkout, but allows them to use alternative currencies like Bitcoin and whatever else. Because our objective is to have the teachers accept whatever the teachers think is money, and the students pay whatever they need to pay to make it work with the teacher. And that's, you know, we'll charge a listing fee then and get out of the way so that the teachers and the students can have at.
Okay. Well, any of you programmers and developers out there, if you're interested in helping out with this project, contact Jim. You just heard the general requirements, fairly basic, simple stuff that you're probably already doing for other people right now.
Yay, team.
So, yeah. Well, we went a little bit over an hour here, and it was a really fascinating story, Jim. Thank you very much for taking the call and going over this and sharing that stuff for it. It was really something to think about.
Okay. And next time we'll have to talk about my trip to Mars.
Okay.
I mean, my plans.
Yeah,
my plans to travel to Mars.
Your agenda, all right. Real quick.
Because you can all go to hell, I'm going to Mars.
Yeah, right. On your topic of the Somalia stuff, one thing I had a question. If people were interested in learning more about the situation over there, are there any websites or Google searches or books that you recommend?
Well, I think one of the best books for understanding the Somali culture and to some extent the minds of some of the Somali traditionalists is by my late friend Michael Van Naughton. It's from Red Sea Press. It's called The Law of the Somalis. And it talks about their traditional system and how they discover law and apply it and how their courts are ad hoc. They're not permanent. So when there's a crime or a tort, there's an incident that needs to be resolved. A court is formed to resolve that incident, and when that crime has been compensated for, when the punishment has been meted out or the negligent party has been made to pay compensation, when the court has rendered its opinion, the court dissolves. And the people who are in the court go back to doing other things. And I think this is a very powerful model.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that if you look at the problems you have day to day in big cities, there's a court building and there's a judge in there and there are clerks and there are bailiffs and there are people who have to be paid. And as long as that court is sitting there, those people are going to be wanting work. And unless there's a lot of crime, they don't have work. So what do? They get together with the city government, and they create a bunch of ordinances, speed limits, parking violations, this and that. And then they send out this army of police to find people who are wrongdoers,
yeah,
so that they can feed the court's appetite for activity. Because
yeah,
if the court is empty, you know, there's nothing going on. Well, how do we make money?
Well,
do we screw people over?
It's openly discussed when they are when they're making up these new ordinances and changing their laws in cities. It blows my mind to hear some of the comments that come out of, not that I follow this, but sometimes I hear it, where they literally are talking about raising funds. They're not talking about crime.
Revenue enhancement. Right.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. Speed limit, speeding tickets are revenue enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
The system wants to make money, and they want it off of your skin. They will make it off of your back. And the reality of a standing court or a standing government or a standing army is that these are parasites. They are not producing anything of value. They are going around breaking windows, right? The police break windows. The army breaks windows. The courts are breaking windows. They are not producing anything of their own. They are not providing anything of value. If you want to provide added value, the Somali model, I think, is a good one. This ad hoc concept where, you know, it comes into existence to deal with a crime and it goes out of existence. Or
yeah,
the militia concept, which is also very Somali. You know, the elders will call up the militia. The militia forms. They appoint a war leader. The war leader leads them in battle. When the war is over, they disband.
Right.
The war leader goes back to being a guy.
Yeah.
If he doesn't, if he wants to seize power, the elders have him killed. You know, that's their model. They don't have a standing army. You don't want a standing army, because what does a standing army do? It's a hammer looking for a window. That's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and if and anyone
and it will find one.
Right.
We'll find one.
And, but it, at the same time, the counterpoint in that justification of having a standard army is, well, if we're invaded or this or that. The thing is that in any case in the U.S. you could get rid of the entire military, and if there ever truly was a threat, okay, there would be no problem finding millions of people to defend themselves. So
right around 200 million Americans own guns, and I believe if you're willing to extend into the antiques the definition of gun, something like 750 million to a billion guns are owned privately. Now, that's not rocket-propelled grenades. And if you were going to get rid of the military, one of the things that I would want to see immediately is the end to the National Rifle Act of 1932 or whatever it is. You would want to have automatic weapons, and you would want to have the ability to have rocket-propelled grenades and other things in private hands, because people need to have that kind of equipment. If you look at Somalia, since 1991, right, so what is this, 20 years going right now, they have had numerous invasions, but they have thrown them back. They've thrown the invaders back again and again. And why is that? It's because they all have guns.
Mm-hmm.
They have 50 caliber machine guns. You know, everybody who has a truck has either a 50 cal machine gun or a 1 pound anti-aircraft gun that he can throw in the back of his pickup truck, and that's a technical, right? Suddenly it's a technical because it's got a gun in it. And they all have a rifle in the garage, you know. You go and stay with a Somali and, you know, sit on the floor and talk, and chew the cat, and, you know, you get taken out to the garage one day, and there's the AK-47 on the wall. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has it. And why is that? Because that's their system for self-defense. That's their system for defending the community against outrage, whether it's from criminals or whether it's from invaders.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans have that. Americans are pussies about this whole issue. They keep talking about, you know, forming the military and supporting the Marines, and I think the chant is USA, USA. You know, how many of them are going over there? It turns out very few. It turns out very few are actually in the military. And what is the military for? It's for overseas adventurism. Yeah. It's a hammer that's looking for glass to break. And they keep fucking breaking windows. I'm tired of it.
Yeah, right. Well, we can vote or we can produce. So I'm producing. I know you are. Any other news on the sovereign individual?
Well, we've been invited to participate in a very interesting business opportunity. I can't really talk about it because of the way the Securities and Exchange Commission regulates these things. Uh-huh. But basically, what we're going to do is have our faculty who want to be involved be paid to do analysis on investment deals as they come up for this one investment opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so that's another major opportunity if you're interested in making a lot of money, not only analyzing deals but being aware of them. You can get down on the ground floor of some stuff, and we think we can have a really large pool of intellectual capital applied to this opportunity. And so that's kind of exciting. We're working out all the details, but it's looking good so far.
Yeah, great. Super. Good to hear that. Okay, well, we'll close it up here. And, man, you started talking about guns and taxation and some of this other stuff.
I'm pushing your buttons, man.
That's like, setting up for, some more shows coming up, so.
You can count on me anytime you need someone to talk.
Okay, great, man. Thanks again, man. I really appreciate it, and we'll have the show up later today with show notes and references to the books that you recommended and
yeah, see if you can find that YouTube video. If I find it, I'll email it to you.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Another great little episode with Jim Davidson, and we'll have him back again soon. No end to the things we can talk with him. Thanks for listening. We're going to close out here with the Crystal Method. I think I'm crystallized. We'll be right back.
massage this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.